You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tomorrow, a group of distinguished scientists will accept what's often called the American Nobels, Lasker Koshland Awards for medical research. Among them will be Dr. Stanley Falco of Stanford University for his 50-plus years of research on bacteria, and Dr. Victor Ambrose of the University of Massachusetts for his work on small bits of RNA. And both scientists join us now to talk about the tiny things that make up and run most of our bodies. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Dr. Falco, you said that humans often underestimate bacteria. What do you mean by that?
Well, they always think of bacteria as being more or less barbarians at the gate to cause harm, but actually humans are more microbial than they are human. There are 10 times more microbial cells than there are human cells. So we have co-evolved together, and they're with us whether we like it or not.
Where are they?
They are in any part of our body that communicates with the environment, basically. So they're in our mouths, our ears, in our intestinal tracts, and they're there by the billions. And we have just really discovered the complexity of that, and that there are hundreds and hundreds of new kinds of microbes that we didn't know existed and have never been studied before, and we don't know what their role is in health or disease.
But should we assume that most of them are good bacteria?
Yes.
Dr. Ambrose, aren't we learning that our own cells are much more complex than we originally thought, too?
Yeah, I think that one of the trends of recent research in biomedical sciences, especially in the study of developmental biology and human disease, has been to find that our cells contain molecules of types that we weren't aware of previously, and are performing complex tasks within cells and communicating amongst cells in fashions that we didn't really know of before.
But this isn't like what we've done with the study of the atom, where we keep on breaking it up into smaller and smaller parts to the point where there are things that are invisible. Is that happening with the cell as well?
No, I don't think so, because the cell is fundamentally a chemical entity. And we really do understand, for the most part, how cells are put together on a physical and a chemical level. It's the organization of information in the cell that directs what the cell does. Which is the area that's the frontier for us.
Well, most people think of DNA as the blueprint for our bodies, and RNA is just these messengers that carry out the DNA's plans for making proteins in cells. So has RNA been misunderstood or not appreciated enough?
I think RNA is a very complex molecule. In other words, the RNA is basically a kind of a polymer that's similar to DNA, but the way it's deployed within cells and utilized, we find it has a capacity performing functions that we weren't aware of before. So not only is it a message from the nucleus to the parts of the cell that make proteins from that information, but also RNAs of various types are involved in that chain of events from the DNA all the way to making proteins.
But your research is in microRNA. So we don't just have RNA, we also have tiny RNA bits in our bodies as well?
Yeah, I should interject here that I'm representing two other scientists who, the three of us are sharing this Lasker Award. That's Gary Ruvkin and David Balcombe. We each of us contributed findings that revealed that there are in cells these very small RNAs of small size, smaller than had been anticipated before. Mostly they were missed because of their small size, because folks had assumed that a molecule like this should be at least of a certain size.
Well, microRNA has been called the biological equivalent of dark matter. Is that a fair description?
That's a nice analogy, because it does refer to the condition that we often find ourselves in as scientists. That is, that we understand a system in a certain way based on what we are aware of, but we should always acknowledge that there are areas and facets of, say, any system, the universe or a living cell, that we just haven't actually become aware of yet because we haven't designed the proper experiment.
So where was microRNA first discovered?
Well, we discovered the first microRNA in the process of trying to do something entirely different. I think this is an important thing to emphasize, is that there was no theoretical reason to say, well, we should look for smaller RNAs than the ones we know about. What we were trying to do was to understand how animal development proceeds and really try to find the genes that were important in that process. And in so doing, we found that a certain gene in a nematode encoded one of these small RNAs and was performing its functions entirely through that little RNA.
Serendipity is often an important factor in science.
Exactly.
And I assume that works just as well in your research into bacteria.
Yeah, serendipity, and a lot depends on who gets born first and at what time, I think, as well, yes.
What do you mean in terms of who discovers something?
Yeah, I mean, if you're in the right place at the right time, very often that's quite important in discovery. Yes.
Well, have you been at Stanford for all the years that you've been working?
No, I began, actually my first job was at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in 1960. And I learned, that's where I learned about really the impact of infectious diseases on human history.
So you were at that time looking at the bad bacteria.
Not necessarily, but at the time, well, I guess you would say that. I was studying typhoid, cholera, and dysentery, so they are bad.
Yeah.
But at the time, we also began to study, and by serendipity, antibiotic resistance. And in the 60s, there was this exuberance that we had conquered infectious diseases and that they were going to be defeated by antibiotics, but we were learning that bacteria were becoming increasingly resistant to these medicines, and we found out that the bacteria really had a quite novel and unique way of becoming resistant very quickly, and that kind of drove our research into areas that had not been explored before.
They make adjustments and then pass those adjustments on to their offspring almost immediately.
Yeah, microorganisms have kind of the equivalent of an internet for information that they use genetically with, and they use mobile genetic elements.
And can they communicate with each other?
They do. They can do this by just coming into contact with one another. They have a kind of primitive sexual apparatus that lets them transfer DNA from one to the other. Some bacteria actually will just take up DNA from the environment, and sometimes viruses, little viruses that feed on bacteria, act as the mediators of this genetic transfer.
Can viruses do this too?
Yes.
Because we've been talking about things that have been resistant to drugs on various levels. This is a major problem, as you say now.
Well, for viruses do it by mutation. The bacteria actually do it by inactivating the antibiotic, and that was a puzzle for a number of years. How did they learn how to do this? And Julian
Davies makes them sound very smart.
Well, they are smart in their sense, biologically smart, and Darwin does work. So it turned out that Julian Davies at the University of British Columbia came up with the idea that the bacteria that actually, and antibiotics are actually made by one microorganism, that and an antibiotic is something that's made by one microorganism that inhibits another. And Julian came up with the idea that if microbes are resistant, who has to be resistant initially? It's the ones that make them. And it turns out that those genes from the organisms that make antibiotics had been more or less disseminated genetically to vast communities of other microbes.
Does this happen with the good bacteria as well? For example, if you are being treated with antibiotics, women especially will develop yeast infections. It's killing off good bacteria in their bodies, and they suffer as a result. And I'm sure that happens in all of us in one way or another, the good bacteria killed off. Did they make the adjustments too?
They make it very quickly and in a broader scale, if you will. Food animals for many decades were fed antibiotics to stimulate growth, and that led to these enormous reservoirs of resistant bacteria in animal populations. And then given the fact that these genetic elements that mediate resistance are mobile, it spread out from the animal populations throughout all microbes, including those that in humans that cause disease.
My guests are two of the winners of this year's Lasker-Koshland Awards, for medical research, Dr. Stanley Falco of Stanford University and Dr. Victor Ambrose of the University of Massachusetts. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with two of this year's Lasker Koshland Award winners for medical research, Dr. Victor Ambrose of the University of Massachusetts, who is being awarded for his work on small bits of RNA called microRNA, and Dr. Stanley Falco of Stanford University for his 50 plus years of research on bacteria. Let's get back to the microRNA. You discovered them while working on nematode worms. Why were you looking at nematode worms? Well, when I say you, you pointed out earlier that you're one of three people who came up with this.
Well, Gary Ruvkin and I were both working on worms, so-called the C. elegans, which is a worm that was selected by Sidney Brenner 30 years ago or so as a model organism that would be used to effectively to study development and the function of the nervous system. The reason he chose it is because it was very simple.
But, also, but would it also give us insight into other beings? Or would, if you look at the RNA and DNA of a nematode worm, do you understand how human RNA and DNA work?
Yes, we now know that since we have the complete genome sequences of nematodes on the one hand and humans on the other, by comparing them, when you can see that they share, in fact, most of the genes are shared between humans and nematodes. A nematode will have has all the same sorts of cells as a human, but much fewer of them. And we know that the way a nematode is put together and the way it develops is using the same toolbox, so to speak, of genes, regulatory genes that are used in the development of a human. The human is just much more complex, and in a way that we don't fully understand. It uses actually the same basic set of genes to manage that much more complex development and behavior.
Does this apply to most living beings? Would there be microRNA in bacteria, Dr. Falco?
I would defer to Victor for this. There are, but I think their function is actually less well known.
Well, you know, in a way, the work that came before our work on small RNAs was mostly done in bacteria, but not on microRNAs per se. The term microRNA has come to refer to a particular kind of RNA that's found only in plants and animals. And this microRNA, the microRNAs in plants and animals are, we know, have evolved from a mechanism for making small RNAs that all plants and animals contain. This is the mechanism of so-called RNA interference, which is a process that was discovered by Andy Fire and Craig Mello, and for which they won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago. So the microRNAs then are, you know, sort of a subset of the kinds of small RNAs that are found in plants and animal cells, of which there are dozens and dozens of different classes of these kinds of small RNAs.
And the microRNA are regulators? Do they?
That's right.
They control the interaction between DNA and RNA?
I think that's why they're so important, I think, is that they are involved in regulation. And, you know, the differences between our cells in the body and are largely defined by which genes are on and which are off. And microRNAs are amongst those molecules that are regulating which genes are on and off, and therefore regulating how our cells respond to the environment and how our cells and organs develop and maintain themselves.
Do we know how many microRNA genes there are in humans?
They're continually being discovered. There are known to be more than 500 different kinds of microRNAs, therefore about 500, perhaps to 1,000 different genes in humans that are encoding these microRNAs.
So they're regulating different processes.
Each of these microRNAs, one can be thought of as to have perhaps dozens or even hundreds of genes that they themselves regulate. So if you think of 500 genes all deployed regulating several dozen or hundreds of genes themselves, they can bring to bear their regulatory, capacity against most of the genes in a cell.
Do we know if microRNA plays a role in some cancers?
Yes, this is an exciting area of microRNA research. Is knowing that a microRNA regulates important processes, it is a regulator of other genes, means that if that microRNA is, say, changed in a during the process of developing a cancer, there's a good potential that that microRNA may underlie some of the properties of that cancer cell. So microRNAs are used as another marker for distinguishing between cancers of different types and determining sort of more deeply what's wrong with that cancer cell as we try to understand how to treat it.
In some cancers like melanoma, a potential cancer cell can live nascent for years and years, and then suddenly it lights up. Is this part of the process?
It's the process, you're right, the process of developing a full-blown cancer, let's say, from an incipient cancer is multiple steps that involve genetic changes and physiological changes to that cell. And we know that those are very complex changes. And amongst the changes that can occur, we now know, are changes in the production of particular microRNAs, which then impact the physiology of that cell and, you know, move it along towards more cancerous properties.
Dr. Falco, your early work involved fingerprinting bacteria. What's involved in the process?
That was the analysis of DNA fragments. This occurred, really, we did that work in the 70s. And we found out that if you cut bacteria with certain DNA with certain enzymes, you would get a kind of molecular fingerprint, and we were able to trace organisms to the source of their epidemics. And the techniques that we used initially are still used to a great extent.
In fact, they're used in medical offices all over the world.
Now they are. I wanted to pick up on one thing, however, if I may, that Victor said, just to, for a moment. And that had to do with your question before about whether or not the studies in worms had any implications for human medicine. And I think it's interesting that the Lasker Awards very often in basic research are for research that are done on microorganisms and worms and fish. And then you look at the people who get the Lasker Award in clinical research, and it turns out that it's based on some of these basic observations, but it takes a period of time of about 20 years. So I did want to make that statement.
And if I could add a point, if I may, about plants as another model organism, because if my co-winner, David Balcombe, was here, he could in a very articulate way point out how his studies of plants contributed to this understanding of small RNAs, because it was he was in the course of studying actually host viral interactions in a plant, discovered small RNAs very much like the microRNAs that we had found in animals. And that discovery of David Balcombe's was really a watershed, so to speak, because it allowed workers to realize that, hey, these things we were finding in worms were very much like these small RNAs that are found in plants. This must mean that a common ancestor of plants and animals were able to make these small RNAs. And that would opened up the realization in people's minds that there could be a vast array of these kinds of small RNAs that had sort of diversified since that common ancestor, and that's been borne out to be true.
And I would imagine that your research actually comes together in an odd way, because since the bacteria are functioning in our bodies both in positive and negative ways, and our body is reacting to both the positive and negative, that the microRNA are part of that whole process.
Well, I am fond of saying that microbes know more about human cell biology and immunology than all Lasker Award winners.
Well, yes. We have all sorts of bacteria in our body that sound bad that function in a positive way. E. coli, for example. What makes one strand of E. coli pathogenic and another one essentially harmless?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The ones that live in our body, they all live in our body, but those that are harmless, if you will, which we call commensals, meaning literally to eat from the same table, but those that cause infection and the primary types are those that cause urinary tract infection. There are those that cause meningitis, and then people know about the hemorrhagic E. coli. And the distinction between the two is that the pathogenic ones have sets of genes that are distinct from those that do not. And they got these genes because of this genetic exchange I talked about earlier.
So have we been creating the bad E. coli?
We don't. You know, we provide microbes with great opportunities that we don't think about by our activities. For example, people are very concerned about Legionnaire's disease, and it seemed to come out of the blue. But actually, it was a microbe that was happily living in water. Living in little freshwater protozoa. And what changed is human behavior. So we don't take baths anymore. We take showers. And in taking showers, we aerosolize the water. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to walk into a supermarket now and not get a little bit sprayed sometimes at the vegetable and produce part. And this provided a new opportunity for Legionella to get into the lungs of people. And the cells that actually patrol the lungs look very much like amoeba, and Legionella found itself with a new opportunity, and we had this evolution of disease. And you can look at a number of other infectious medical problems that have similar kinds of roots.
And so many of these bacterial responses are ingenious. Haven't some bacteria developed ways to pump antibiotics out of the cell wall?
It's a very common mechanism. They have a little pump that they utilize, yes.
How does this apply to the antiretroviral drugs that have been developed to treat HIV? Do they mutate? Have they caused the HIV viruses to make adjustments as well?
They clearly do make adjustments. Viruses have smaller genetic toolboxes, and they do it much more by mutation. And it's a balancing act for the virus, if you will, because you have to look at the virus from the viruses and bacterial standpoint, in a sense, is that their job is to replicate and make more of themselves. That's what
they're on Earth for.
That's exactly right. So they have to make a balance between being resistant and still being able to survive in the presence of competitors, which are the other viruses. And they've done a remarkable job of doing so. I mean, when you think about the basic problem, we have a fairly simple virus. We know all the genes. We now know virtually all the genes that are in the human. And one would think it should be quite easy, for example, to develop a vaccine or some therapeutic against this. But it's very difficult.
As we learned recently, when a very promising vaccine turned out to not be effective.
That's right.
My guests are Dr. Stanley Falco of Stanford University, Dr. Victor Ambrose of the University of Massachusetts, two of this year's Lasker Koshland Award winners for medical research. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Ambrose, can you tell us about anti-microRNA molecules?
Yeah, this is an area of considerable excitement because we know that some microRNAs play roles that one can think of as bad in a disease context. So, for example, there's a microRNA that's known to promote enlargement of the heart and inflammation, you know, in association with heart attacks or other kinds of heart disease.
Also hepatitis?
There's also a microRNA whose role is to actually function in the replication of a virus, in liver cells. So one can imagine that if you could inhibit that microRNA specifically and not cause any other damage or side effects, then you could reverse, that disease condition. And there's a lot of activity in basic sciences and in biotech research to develop these anti-microRNA drugs that would be employed in situations where we know that a microRNA is contributing to the disease.
So this is the same sort of thing as we've been talking about with bacteria in the body. There are positive things that we get from bacteria and sometimes negative things. And often it can be the same mm-hmm. bacteria, the same cell.
That's right.
Is microRNA steering the cell as much as DNA is, or is RNA in general steering the cell as much as DNA is? Because I've always thought of it as being the, you know, the way I was taught in school was there's this DNA, and then there is a kind of an attraction to various, is it acids or, and then you wind up with this RNA strand that then goes and does the job that the DNA has assigned to it.
Yeah, the DNA is the instructions, the blueprint, so to speak, for making a cell and also for building the machinery within a cell that is going to enable that cell to respond to its environment and sort of connect up and do the things it's supposed to do. That information has to get from the DNA to something that can be actually used to build a cell or to implement some process. That's the messenger RNA. It's a multiple copies of a given gene are made, and that those multiple copies then enable the cell to make lots and lots of product that's encoded from that gene. And it's the regulation of that process that's key to making cells different from one another and enabling the cell to respond to conditions and so forth, and, of course, enabling an animal or a plant to develop from a single cell to a very complex organism. All those instructions have to be regulated with great precision.
Has it always been thus, or have we seen changes as a result of what Dr. Falco has called, discussed when he has said that we should call many emerging infectious diseases diseases of human progress?
I think that micro.
I mean, if I were to look at the cells of somebody who lived 3,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, would I pretty much be seeing the same thing as I'd be seeing today?
I guess what we would probably notice if we had examined a set of patients from thousands of years ago to today is that most of the people today would be older than the people of those days. And so because we have been able to, you know, evade infectious agents to some degree anyway, and we've been able to increase our, you know, nutrition and so forth, we live longer. Now we are a population consisting of people who now have to cope with diseases of aging. And I think that that's the kind of perhaps shift that we're going to continue to see, and we'll learn more and more now about the human biology of aging and hopefully try to manage those age-related diseases better as we go forward.
In the case, I just quoted you, Dr. Falco,
yes.
the emerging infectious diseases as diseases of human progress. In the past, we thought, as you said earlier, that antibiotics would pretty much eliminate all of those diseases, and they're not going away, and we're seeing a resurgence of tuberculosis and other diseases. So can we pretty much predict now where we're going to go based on the drugs that we have developed to fight the previous generation of bacteria?
I think actually that the host-pathogen interactions are a work in progress. And I take the view that the microbes in the end always win. I mean,
So there's never going to be a time when we're going to totally overcome disease.
I think that since we have so many that is part of us that have co-evolved, I think we're not destined to live in a sterile world at all.
And should we be washing our hands with antibiotic soap?
I think if you're a physician in a hospital going from patient to patient, you absolutely should do that. But I think we become a society that's overwhelmed with the idea of destroying germs, as it were, that are bad. It's not going to happen.
Well, even if it was, that would end your research if we get rid of all this.
No, I have, as I said, you know, the first living thing you encounter when you're born is a microbe. And you carry them the rest of your life, and then when you die, they consume you. So I know they're doing well.
Congratulations to both of you for receiving the Lasker Koshland Award. Actually, it'll be tomorrow.
Yes.
Yes.
And thank you so much for being on our show today. I've been talking with Dr. Stanley Falco of Stanford University and Dr. Victor Ambrose of the University of Massachusetts. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Thank you.